one of the traditionally most tantalizing sources of problems and statistics has been the enumeration of populations of wild creatures. I think this is must be amongst the earliest attempts that Peter's going to talk about to actually do it by eye, so to speak.
Yes.
So that being the case,
yes.
Off you go.
Thank you. Hello everybody. I'm Peter Prattwell from the Antarctic Survey. I'm the geographic information scientist. So my job is really to analyse my own data or other people's data geographically, usually using GIS and remote sensing as well from satellites and photography. And that often poses with a number of challenges. What we're going to talk about today really is mainly our friend the emperor penguin, iconic bird, and trying to assess the population of emperor penguins in Antarctica. Something we've been doing now for about 5 years. What was special about this particular survey is that we actually imaged and counted the whole population of emperor penguins in one go. So it was the first synoptic comprehensive survey of a species from space. Without spluttering too much. And I thought when we started this, well, from a statistical point of view, you know, a population biologist, heavy users of statistics, and the premise there is you can't count everything, so you take a small sample of the population, you extrapolate out using known parameters to give you the whole population. We'd be taking that part of it away, and I thought we'd be using less statistics, but actually by having more information and better information, I actually found almost the reverse was true, and we could do more with the data, and therefore we actually used quite a lot of maths and statistics when we were trying to finalise the final population. So the format of this talk for about between 3/4 of an hour and an hour. I'm going to introduce the species. There are some specific things about emperor penguins which make it unique and interesting from a scientific point of view. And then I'm going to talk about our first challenge, which is identifying the locations where the emperor penguins breed, the breeding colonies. And then talk a little bit about how we did that. And then about counting the emperor penguins from space by satellite. And then assessing the populations. And then a little bit about what we're doing now and future efforts, and then a bit more context about what we're doing with other species as well, and some of the techniques we're using to monitor and analyse their populations. Some of which you may be aware of, have been in the news recently, and some are just on the near horizon. So let's start with our friend the emperor penguin. Oh, and apologies, we're going to have a lot of nice photos, most of my own, probably a little bit light on some of the stats possibly, but lots of nice photos anyway to compensate. So emperor penguins, iconic. When you think of Antarctica and the wildlife in Antarctica, you think of penguins, and it's usually the emperor penguin you think of. Biggest of the penguin species, but what makes it really unique isn't its size, but its very, very strange breeding habit. I know you may have seen the various Hollywood or BBC natural history programmes about emperor penguins. The really thing that makes it unique is that it breeds on the sea ice, not on the land at all. So it sometimes never ever touches the land. Sea ice is just frozen sea. So the sea freezes in Antarctica, the birds breed on the sea ice. And to do that, they have to breed in the Antarctic winter. So the only creature that breeds in the winter in Antarctica, a very, very extreme environment where temperatures can get down to minus 50, it's always windy because of the katabatic winds, and it's dark for most of the time as well. So a very, very unique characteristic, which poses lots of challenges. Then there's the threat they have from climate change, which again is linked to that sea ice. I'll talk a little bit about that. And then we'll talk a little bit about a lack of knowledge of the species.
Could I just ask, thinking about what you said about breeding on the sea ice in the winter, I was just wondering, as it were, which way around things work there. Is it because they like to breed in really cold therefore have to wait for winter, therefore the only accessible ice is sea ice?
No.
Or do they have a preference somehow for sea ice as such?
The sea, they've evolved over millions of years to breed on the sea ice. We think probably because they have there's nothing else that breeds there, so there are no predators there,
right.
There's no competition there. If you can evolve to breed on the sea ice, then you've got a massive advantage. There's lots of food under the sea ice. You've got acres, you can do it wherever you like, because Antarctica doubles in size when the sea ice forms in the winter. So if you can evolve to breed on the sea ice in the Antarctic winter, then you've got no competitors and no competition, which obviously makes it a great place to be if you can do that.
And you have frozen prawns in the sea ice.
Well, the sea ice, because it's frozen, the sea only goes down about a metre or two,
yeah.
Because of the insulation. So there's always, and usually there's quite an active layer under there with
right.
biology, so you feed all the way through the water. So that life cycle. The sea starts to freeze in about April, and the penguins arrive. About April time, they do their courtship and mating, and then they lay an egg, usually about June time, in the depths of the winter when it's darkest. The female goes off back into the sea and leaves the male to incubate the egg. The male then huddles together with all these other mates, and the other males. They huddle, the huddle circulates to keep warm, and they stay incubating the egg for about 6 weeks. About 6 weeks, the eggs hatch, the females turn back up, and from then on, from about August time onwards, you find that the adults take it in turns foraging, so one's usually out foraging, and the other one is looking after the chick, until about December time when the chicks are old enough to look after themselves. And about end of December, usually, the sea ice breaks up, and the chicks fledge, sea ice breaks up, and there's no trace left of the penguin colony. So if you think about it, this happens all in the winter months. Us scientists, we like to go there in the summer months, when it's reasonably temperate, at least, you know, it's a few degrees below zero, not minus 50, and there's light. So often the scientists don't ever see the penguins, because the penguins have gone by the time scientists turn up. So you don't want to be there as a human, you want adapted to living at minus 50 in the dark, so you don't want to be there in the winter, the penguins don't want to be in the summer. But there's a problem with them breeding on the sea ice. As we see in the Arctic has lost a lot of sea ice with climate change. And the prediction is that although Antarctica hasn't lost a lot of sea ice yet, it will lose a lot of sea ice in the next 50 to 100 years, and therefore we will lose a lot of emperor penguin colonies. But we're going to lose a large percentage of the population. I think it's something like 60% is suggested that we might lose over the next, 60% over the next 6 years, or 50% over the next 60 years or so. There's a concern there and a need to understand the relationship with the sea ice and the emperor penguins. How bad is it? Can the emperor penguins adapt to these changing conditions? Will they move? Will they stay where they are? What will happen when we lose all of the sea ice? So that relationship with the sea ice that the penguins have, and they have to breed on sea ice, we think, or most of the colonies breed on sea ice. There's a very, very strong relationship there. That's a big advantage for them, but also if we get changes in that sea ice, then we're going to lose emperor penguins. But there's another problem caused by this unique breeding habit. As I suggested earlier, emperor penguins aren't there when the scientists are there, and the scientists aren't there when the emperor penguins are there. So we found that it's very difficult to find where the emperor penguins live, and even more difficult when you get there to count them, because they breed in some of the most remote places in the world where the conditions are extremely challenging in the wrong time of year. We've seen those documentaries, we've seen emperor penguins, photos of them, things like that, but they almost all happen at one or two colonies. where there is an Antarctic base next to the actual Emperor Penguin Colony. For instance, March of the Penguins, the famous film about Emperor Penguins, it looked like it's in the middle of nowhere, actually was a few hundred yards from the French base of Dumont d'Urville. And it's just clever camera work that allowed them to be portrayed in the middle of the wilderness. In fact, I've spoken to French cameramen, they say they can sit on their verandas sipping their espressos and watch the Emperor Penguins in front of them. And the same is true for the Frozen Planet and other things like that. They're usually close to, or at least relatively close to, bases. There are some penguin colonies that are thousands and thousands of miles from the nearest base and entombed in the sea ice that have never been seen by humans until now. So this, of course, is a problem estimating the population. Some of the population estimates we have been very sketchy. Ships have arrived at the wrong time of year, seen a few chicks, and tried to estimate the population by saying, well, there's so many chicks here, we think the size of that colony was so large. And if you look through the actual the long list of sightings of Emperor Penguin colonies, there's a real problem with trying to match up the colonies, information, and trying to even get an idea of how good that information is. We found that some colonies where people in the past in historical records, and this is true of many sort of remote breeding animals, you have to look at historical records and you're there looking at things that might have changed or might have been erroneous. We know that one colony was supposed to be 40,000 strong, potentially the largest colony in the world, didn't exist at all. It was just a group of molting penguins they'd seen on the ice rather than breeding colony. So nobody's really been willing to make an estimate for some time now of the Emperor Penguins. No scientist was willing to stick their neck out and say this is how many there are. And this has been made worse because we knew that there were probably colonies out there, an unknown number of colonies that existed that we'd never discovered. How can you tell what the population is if there are lots of colonies out there you've never discovered, an unknown number? You don't really have a clue what percentage you actually know about. So how can you tell what the estimate of the population is? And if you can't tell what the estimate of the population is, how can you say how vulnerable it is to climate change? So this was a real problem that we found. And even though new colonies had been found between 1992 and 2009, nobody had added those into the mix. And to give you an idea, one example of some of the many accidents that have happened looking for Emperor Penguin colonies. This happened with Bass scientists. In 1958, every year we used to send out scientists using sledges across the sea ice, the frozen sea, to go and count a small colony on the Deer Islands where there are only a couple of hundred penguins. It's about 40 kilometres across the sea ice. They went out early in the season when the sea ice wasn't particularly great. The next day a storm blew up and the three scientists were never seen again. This is just one of several instances looking for penguins where there have been horrendous accidents, because it's really, the sea ice, you don't want to be on the sea ice. It's tenuous at the best of times and it's dark and it's cold as well. So it's very hard, even when you do know where the colonies are, to go out and count them because they're such remote and dangerous areas. And that's where I came into the situation and British Antarctic Survey. As I said, we hadn't published a paper on Emperor Penguins for about 50 years, till about 2009. Now, I'm a scientist by training, but at this time I was doing cartography for British Antarctic Survey, and I was mapping some, just maps for pilots. We've got a number of aircraft, and we do some mapping for pilots. And one of the things that they need on their maps is they need the locations of the birds to tell them where not to fly too low, because they've got restrictions about how high they fly over penguins, about 2,000 feet. But we had no real knowledge about where the penguins were. So I'd been actually mapping the coastline as well for this map, and I'd noticed that in one particular area, I was particularly trying to find this one, because I knew it wasn't on this ice shelf. This grey area is an ice shelf, which is glacial ice which has flowed off of the land and is now floating on the sea, several tens of metres high. They wouldn't be on there, we didn't think. They must be on near the coast somewhere. And I'd been looking around the coast and I'd actually seen these brown stains in one of the ice creeks. Now this is the ice shelf, so glacial ice. This is sea ice, the frozen sea, where the Empanemans breed. And I'd seen this brown stain and I couldn't work out what would be a brown stain on frozen sea, because it should be perfectly white. And then this question came to me about, well, where's this Empanemans colony? I put two and two together. Well, it could be the Empanemans colony. I took it to our ecologists and they said, well, yes, that could be the guano stain, because the Empanemans breed, they're there for 8 months of the year, they need a big brown stain there. This is using coarse resolution satellite imagery, Landsat, which is about 30 metres by 30 metres, about 100 feet by 100 feet. So quite coarse. So you can't see the penguins with this imagery, but the advantage of this imagery is that Landsat's been up for a long time and it fires off images continually, one a month, of every part of the globe. So you've got a really good archive. Went around the coastline looking for other colonies and I started to see more of these brown stains, let's not make them out, in places on the sea ice where we shouldn't have brown stains. Some of them matched with known colony locations or close, some of them didn't. And talking to our ecologists, well, they said, well, best thing to talk to Jerry Coomans, he's the world expert on penguins, and see what he thinks. So I asked him, and he said, well, can you see the Cape Washington colony? He gave me the location, and this is what we could see. Big brown stain, it's one of the largest penguin colonies in the world. Big brown stain, guano, I showed it to him, and he said, well, that's brilliant, you can see the guano stain, but these satellite stains are probably the penguins themselves that have moved away from the stain. So knowing this, we set a project out to go and automatically find the colonies using the spectral coloration. So you use a red filter, you look for red things on the sea ice, and you can do that using thresholding of the red band, or of a, in our case we used a relationship between the blue and the red bands, and we pulled out all of the areas where the red was larger than blue on the sea ice, and that gave us potential penguin colonies. And actually it was very, very accurate at finding those colonies. Because this satellite's been going for many years and we had massive coverage, we covered about 90% of the coastline using that.
Just another quick little question out of curiosity on that previous slide. What is it that makes those pits?
These?
Yes.
Ah, we'll come on to that in a moment. We'll come on to that in a moment because they're not pits. They're actually the penguins themselves. So this is the guano, which is brown. The penguins tend to be darker.
No, I don't mean the darker. Well, I don't mean the stains. I mean the things that look like holes.
Oh, here. Yes. They're icebergs. So these birds.
Oh, I see. So they're sticking up.
Yeah, they're sticking up. Yes, it's probably just the angle of the image there. So they're sticking up. Yeah, they're the icebergs.
Right.
Penguins tend to, especially penguins, tend to be around icebergs because sometimes they like to get out of the wind and they'll shelter behind them.
So the sun's coming from
Yes. So, nothing inappropriate comes up. So, before we started our survey, we had good locations of about 25 emperor penguin colonies, and we had suspected locations of about 10, where ships had gone past, they'd seen penguins, maybe one or two, or a group of penguins, but they'd never located the actual colony. We did our penguin survey, we found 10 new colonies, but now, using higher resolution imagery, we've actually got 52 colonies. So we've more than doubled the number of known colonies, and all of those are confirmed sites. So we can I'll show you how we confirm them in a moment. But continually throughout this process, when I published this paper, this was published in 2009, and that was looking for these colonies and trying to redo the distribution. One of the questions we got asked continually was, well, that's great, but can you tell us what the population is? That really need to know the population. And now, of course, knowing where the colonies are is the first step to finding out the population. You can't work out what the population is if you don't know where the colonies are in the first place. So I thought, well, that's the first step. And You can't do the Landsat because you haven't got the resolution for Landsat. But with this satellite, one of the new generation of very high resolution satellites from Digital Flow, you can. This satellite's got an on-the-ground resolution of 50 centimetres. So smaller than the probably about the chair, maybe about smaller than the chair, something like that, so you can see. So with that, you can actually see much better resolution. You can see the difference between the guano here. This is the same Halley Bay colonies we saw earlier. Guano here and the actual huddles of penguins themselves, or groups of penguins here. And so you can start to see those. And if you zoom in more, then you can actually see individual penguins. So you can, because you've got great contrast between the ice and a black penguin, it's brilliant in Antarctica. These are penguins. You can see the tracks they've made as they walk from their colony to the sea on their foraging trips and come back. So you can actually count individual penguins. And often you can count individual penguins when they're spaced apart, but as we know, emperor penguins like to huddle, especially in the cold weather, so more often than not they're in huddles and you can't individually count them, so you need a different method. And you could theoretically go around and get an automated process which pulls out each black pixel, but more often than not you're looking at a group, so you then need to work out some sort of methodology to pull out how big the group is and also differentiate it from the guano and the snow and then convert that to a population. Now, this had already been started by Jerry Kurbins and his student Shannon Barbara Meyer in 2007, and we developed it, we developed the methodology along with Jerry. Jerry helped me with this one, and we took the imagery, so that very high resolution, I think it's QuickBird and WorldView are the two satellites that can do this. And basically they've got different types of information on each satellite. They have colour bands, red, blue, green and infrared, and they have black and white bands. The black and white is almost always higher resolution, so that's panchromatic band is 50 centimetres. The colour, you can see the resolution here is much better than the colour band. But using the intensity of the black and white band and the hue and saturation of the colour band, you can sort of do something called pan sharpening, which mixes that information together and gives you a colour image at the resolution of the black and white band. So 50 centimetre colour image. And what's doing it's using the saturation and hue from the colour and the actual intensity from the black and white band. So by doing that, it gave us a much better resolution and better results than Jerry was getting originally. And then you can use that to classify the penguins. And we use a multivariate classification, a supervised classification methodology, where you tell the computer what's a penguin, what's guano, what's snow. You give it training pixels, a number of training pixels, and then it can go away and classify the pixel, basically gives a class to each of the pixels in the image, and it does it quite successfully, as you can see. It will classify that image quite well. And this is, we'll get into some of the more mathematical part of the process. Because to work out then, you've got an idea then of the area you've got of penguins, what the area is. And again, it works whether you've got clustered penguins or whether you've got spaced apart penguins, as long as you know what. It will pick out, it will still pick them out relatively well. But of course, then you need to convert the area to an actual number of penguins. And this is complicated by a number of things. We did have some ground truthing, and most of the ground truthing is from our twin otter planes flying over the colonies and taking either oblique aerial photographs or in one or two cases vertical aerial photographs. So this is what they'll see when they fly over these black areas, those black areas of penguins, and when you go in close and you take a photograph, this is what you get. And then it's up to somebody or usually two or three people to go and count each of these and get an estimate of the numbers. And usually the process here is we have three counters and they we make a mean of the count. If it's within 5%, we accept it. If it's not within 5%, we have to put more counters in to the process.
Right, linking back now to an earlier one, when you are taking the relatively coarse grid photograph, essentially you will be getting, as it were, shades from dark grey through to black depending upon the density of penguins.
Yes, there's a number of considerations depending on where the pixel hits the penguin.
Yeah.
And the things
but
like that.
You know, you could have lots of penguins in one pixel,
yes,
and then that pixel would be effectively be black.
Absolutely.
But you know, as it spreads out, it gets.
It's never going to be precise.
It's never going to be precise. But you could take one of those photographs, classified by shades of black, and calibrate it against a few of these.
Well, that's what we'll come off of in a moment.
Oh, okay.
So we've got these things here. It's complicated by a number of factors. As we said, things to do with the shadows, the intensity, but also a lot of these are chicks. And what you're actually trying to count are adults. So there's a mixture of chicks and adults in there as well. Now, usually, at this time of year that we're doing this, you have one chick per adult, because emperor penguins only ever have one chick, and there's always a chick and an adult there as well. So we make the assumption that at the time of year that we're there, there's one adult per chick and only one adult per pair, because the other one's out foraging.
Ah.
That's a fairly robust assumption from studies we've done so far. So we've got 11 ground truthing counts. We knew that they wouldn't be there were going to be a number of issues with them, so we wanted to find out how good a density estimate was going to be. So we looked at a number of ways of doing it. We just ran a straight regression through it, and it gave us a reasonably good idea, about, I think it was 92%, but you can see that it's weighted rather badly to one big colony in the Washington colony up here. So we ran a robust regression through it as well, and that gave us an even better result, but it still wasn't, I think the robust regression was giving us probably something that wasn't really particularly, it was right, but it wasn't giving us the whole truth, because it was giving us a result.
And if anything, down at the bottom left-hand corner, what I can see of it indicates that it has a slope greater than the regression line.
In some cases, yes. We've got more...
And that's quite possibly due to your very influential observation at the top.
Yes, yeah. So we didn't take this regression line.
Yeah.
What we did was we did the robust regression, and then we did a Monte Carlo analysis to test out some of the accuracy for each of the colonies. And these are different colonies to the ones we used for our survey. So they're totally independent, but ones that we had information and ground truthing for at the time. But I knew also that we had different qualities of imagery which were affecting the accuracy of the counts. And the images, I classified them into three different types, depending on the quality of the image. Basically, the staining of the guano, that was sometimes had quite an effect on the actual ability of our counters to give the same result. And whether it was the contrast, if the contrast was bad on the image, or if we had some misty images as well. Each of them affected the actual quality of the counts. We did this with a number of different counters. I think we used four different counters to see how close together those counts were going to be. And we found that for the good images, we got within about 7% with our four counters. With the mediocre images, it was about 15%, and with the bad images, there was quite a variance. They were maybe 30% either side. So we classed each of the colonies, knowing what the satellite, we classed each of the images from the colonies, and that affected our results and our accuracy.
When you say sample images from each class were analysed by four users, does that mean they actually got in there and counted the dots?
They did the multivariate classification.
Ah.
So each of those did the multivariate classification.
So they weren't actually using like one of your really good photos to count and cross-calibrate against a real count?
Yeah, no, they were using, so that the really good counts were often given to us independently by other surveys, so we had to take those as gospel truth. But it is something that I'll come on to in a moment as well, because that's another source of potential error. So that was used to give us an extra idea of the accuracy of our multivariate classification. But the multivariate classification only tells us so much. What that's telling us then is we're estimating, it's giving us an estimate of the number of adults there in that image at that time of year. Even if it's 100% accurate, what it's giving us is just the adults at that time, in that image at that time of year. And there are lots of other considerations that we have to think about if we want to then multiply that and work out what the total population is. So for instance, I'll use my pointer here. So we've got the supervised classification, gives us the area of penguins at each colony. We have several assumptions about how many chicks there are, and the adults there are at the nesting site. We have the ground truthing, we have to think about, is the ground truthing right or not? Is that 100% accurate? And then there's the relationship between the statistical analysis. We're then converting it using a penguins per pixel. So that is our penguins per pixel estimate correct using those at the Bush regression. And that gives you then, down to here, which is the number of penguins at that site. So this is number of the area, and down here you get the number of area, well down here you get the number of penguins at that site at that time of year from that image. But then there's a seasonal assumption, because by autumn when you're taking a photograph, because you can't take it in June because it's totally dark and there are no planes going over there anyway, June is when the whole population turns up the brim. So that would be the best time to take the photograph because the whole population is there. But by autumn, you will have already lost some of that population. Some of the eggs will have failed to hatch, some of the chicks will have died, and those adults then will have left. So then you have to have another multiplier that tells you from the autumn population what is the actual breeding population. Now we have statistical evidence from other surveys that were done by the French at de Montdeville suggesting that it was about, we lost about 20% by this time of year. But again, if your image was taken earlier in the season, you might be sort of, you've got to take that into account opposed to late in the season, because you may have lost some of the population in the intervening period. Our images were taken within about a 2-month window. So we were in quite a, we don't get a lot of mortality in that window, but we did get some, so we have to take that into consideration as well. And that gives you a yearly population estimate. What is the breeding population at that site for that year? But again, that's only the breeders, and only about 90% of the total population turn up to breed. So you've got to add another 10% if you want the total breeding population, if you want the total breeding population. And then, of course, there's the interannual variability as well. So you sort of started to think about, well, what do we actually want from a breeding population? If you have this ability to get really good information about the whole population, if you want to get the whole population at this time of year, what is it they actually want? Do you want chicks? Do you want juveniles? Do you want the sort of interannual population, or do you want the population just at that time for that year? Well, we decided we were going to go with the population, the yearly population for that year, because then if we had multiple surveys, which we were hoping to do in different years, we could work that out, and we could look at how the populations vary from year to year. So we're looking at a precise estimate from one season for each population, for each individual colony, and we were lucky to get every single colony except two of the 50 odd colonies that there are imaged in the same year within that 2-month window. And those two, well actually it was three, because Sue had already broken up because they'd had bad sea ice here, so you could say that the breeding population there did exist, but you can't count it because it had gone, so it would be an unsuccessful breeding year for them. One, we found later in the season and we had to get an image from the year before. But in this particular survey, we had 46 colonies counted. So it was pretty much the whole population, missing one or two that had broken up earlier in the year. And we had a great big table of lots and lots of different variables and sort of the estimates. You can't read this table, it's too much, but it's all of the Monte Carlo estimate in there of what the variance was, whether it was a good or poor or reasonable image, and what the previous count was, to give us some idea of whether it was anything like the previous count. Judging by the fact that you get a lot of interannual variability at these sites as well, so you can't really say that it was a bad count because it was different to the last count, because you may have lost. It varies. Some of the colonies vary by 50% from year to year. So it's very hard to then judge interannual variability based on that. So I say we did almost the whole population, bar about three colonies. And lo and behold, we got a population estimate which was double the previous population estimate, which didn't really surprise us because we doubled the number of known colonies. Made perfect sense that it was going to be approximately double. Interestingly enough, that last population estimate, when they did it in 92, they came out with error bars which were small and concise, but obviously although they did a reasonably rigorous job, they were working with very poor data, and they could only analyse what they had. We think that our method, because it's a single methodology, a single season, is about reasonably robust, and those error bars are actually reasonably robust as well. It's about 80,000 either side, 595,000 individuals, with about 81,000 plus or minus. We've actually found a couple more colonies since here, so, but they would fall within that error bar. So there we go, it's the first synoptic survey of a species from space. And hopefully we might start doing other species in this way as well. Doubling the number of known emprapens, of course there aren't any more there than there used to be, it's just we found more colonies. So what next? Well, we're continuing to acquire imagery.
What is the data that
Now we have the area, so we have the area of penguins at each site. We do this multivariate classification to pull out the area, and we have ground truthing, which then we try and get a density from the ground truthing, which will then apply to the area to give us a population count for each colony. Add up all the colonies, get a total.
But in the previous scatter plot, the area appeared on the vertical axis.
Yes.
And the population on the vertical axis.
Oh yes, that's the one way around,
isn't
it? Yes, the wrong way around, sorry. Apologies. You know.
Well spotted. Yes.
Spotted. So,
in fact, the length of the error bar is about the same proportion.
Probably is. I think it's a bit bigger in proportion. I think it would be small, but as I said, they didn't have as many, I don't think they put as many criteria in there. Working out the errors as we did, because they just didn't have the information.
On that basis, I mean, given it's approximate, you have effectively a constant coefficient of variation.
Yes, quite probably, yes. Although there, the parameters they used to work out their error bar were somewhat different to ours, because they're using physical counts, so they didn't have the area density problems that we had. We're actually using physical counts, but what their problem was that many of the counts were done at the wrong time of year, So they're looking at different sources of error to
do that. Do you have any idea of what the lifetime penguin is and what distribution thereof?
Yes. Your average lifespan is just over 20 years for an emperor penguin. It doesn't breed until it's about 4 or 5 years old. In the wild, they can live up to about 40 years, and they will continue breeding throughout their adult life.
Every year.
And about 90% of them at any given year breed, which is very high for seabirds. Many seabirds will take years off and only breed every now and again. But then some seabirds live very long time. Petrels, they will live for 40 to 60 years. Whereas an emperor penguin lives a lot less than that, so it has to breed. And it can only have one chick every year. So
can you get any migration from colony to colony?
That's a very, very good question. Now, I'm going to talk about this. I haven't got any slides about this, but it's something that has really caused a bit of an argument in the scientific circles, because the De Mont de Ville colony, where all of the work's been done previously, is this one just here. Next to the French base, and I would say at least 90% of all emperor penguin science has been done at that base. And all of our studies about how penguins adapt to climate change, what their breeding phenology is, and all of that has all come from that colony. For years they tagged emperor penguins to see if they did move between, if we got migration or emigration in different years. And they decided that there was, they didn't ever found any at the other colonies that were there or here. And therefore they made the assumption that they didn't get any immigration, that they came. And so any changes they got at that colony, they attributed to environmental changes like climate change. So and then they wrote a big paper in Nature saying, we've seen a huge drop in the population. It dropped by about 50% over a couple of years, which happened to be bad sea ice years. And then they attributed that to climate change. So this is what's going to happen if we get climate change. But what they didn't know was that actually there are two very large colonies right next door to it that they've never found.
What scale, distance scale is that?
We haven't got a distance bar on it, but that's probably about, let's think, that's about 800 miles, I think, between that dot and that dot. So the foraging distance of an emperor penguin is about a maximum foraging distance from the colony of about 270 kilometres. So these dots would be well within the foraging distance of an emperor penguin. So there would obviously be interaction between those colonies. So we're just writing a paper at the moment, putting this all into context. The French they've had 200 papers from this particular long-term monitoring. It's been going for 50 years. They've had 200 papers from this one particular long-term monitoring thing that they've been doing, and they are not happy that we're going to sort of say this, because there's obviously a lot of...
If you took it perhaps to extremes, if there was no migration, why would you have multiple colonies?
Yes, and we know that some of the colonies have to move, because, for instance, there's an ice tongue here. This penguin colony is on that ice tongue, it's called the Mertz Glacier colony, and it was right on the edge of the ice tongue, which is about 100 kilometres long, and then 4 years ago the ice tongue broke off. Next year the emperor penguin colony disappeared, wasn't there at all. Next year it formed in a different place, further up the ice tongue. Further down the ice tongue, about 100 kilometres from where it had been before, and next year it formed in a different place. So we know that they do move if we get environmental need to move, if there's an environmental need to move. So having this sort of closed attitude that they don't move is rather short-sighted. However, having said that, the De Mont colony is in a group of islands, and the sea ice there is fast ice that's locked in by the group of islands. So that probably doesn't have that dynamic relationship that the one on the Mertz does. So there's other things to think about there as well. But it's a very, very, very interesting question, and it's something that's in the mix at the moment. We're thinking of tagging colony, doing another tagging study on some of these more close colonies to see if they do have that interchange. Because if they do, then some of those papers may be wrong.
Has there ever been any population genetics work on emperor penguins, which could be used
again,
to look at population structure patterns?
We're looking at that at the moment. The people have been out. A guy called Tom Hart at London Zoo is pulling genetics together from feathers, because you can use feathers that they hold a little tiny bit of blood at the end of the feather. And you can go and get the feathers, you can get blood from them. And yes, we're doing that at the moment to try and see what the genetics and the structure is. And it gets us to answer these sorts of questions: how much interchange do you get? We know that sometimes they split up in some cases. It's a very interesting question. So that's one of the things we're doing at the moment, although I haven't got any slides about it. We're now taking imagery every year. We're trying to acquire more ground truthing, because as you see, our ground truthing plot wasn't perfect. We'd like to fill that in a little bit more to try and get a better estimate of the actual density, and also see how that density changes in different conditions, different lighting conditions, different density of huddles and things like that. Can we get the same results and things like that? So we need to get more and more ground truthing, and that will hopefully refine our error estimates and give us more confidence in our estimates. And then I think we're hoping to get a big grant sort of January next year, which will then go and do an 8-year study on it. And 8 years is probably not enough to answer the question about climate change, but 8 years is probably long enough to at least link it into the El Nino Southern Oscillation Cycle that tells us something about climate variability. So then we can tell us something about climate variability and hopefully answer some of the questions about climate change, even if we can't say exactly what we're going to do. So that's what our plans are for that. That's emperor penguins. But another thing that we found also, well, I'll skip through this because we're going, I don't know, what's our time?
Fine.
Yep, okay. There's quite a lot still to go. Another unexpected finding is we're starting to see behavioural changes with the satellite imagery as well, not just the population or distribution patterns. This chap, Carl Anton Larsen, was an explorer. He's actually a sealer, but he did a bit of exploration in his spare time, and he went into the Weddell Sea, which is a bit down the eastern side of the Antarctic Peninsula, while he was sealing, and he recorded the first ever emperor penguin colony, or at least that's what he said, but nobody could ever find it after he'd been there. He said it was in an ice creek off the shelf. People looked for it, we looked for it, and our satellite images, we couldn't find it. So we couldn't verify that there was ever been an emperor penguin colony there on the sea ice. However, our Australian friends on an aerial survey told us that they'd actually seen some emperor penguins breeding about 200 up on the ice shelf. So knowing this, I went back to the satellite images, and here we've got the satellite image used. This is sea ice here. This is the ice cliff that divides the ice shelf, which is glacial ice, from the sea ice. Here, there's a small brown blob here, which is actually on the ice shelf, not on the sea ice. And if you zoom in on that with the satellites, you can actually see that that is a breeding emperor penguin colony on the ice shelf. So they don't just breed on the sea ice. In extremes, if the environment conditions require it, they will move up onto the ice shelf. And people are, well, how do they get up and down off the ice shelf? A very good question, because we just don't know, but we do know that they do it, because you can see them just here doing it. That's probably about 10 metres high. It's not high, it's not massively high, but we have found four of these colonies, and some of them go down ice cliffs which are up to 30 metres high, 100 feet, bigger than this building. So yeah, quite interesting. That's just an aside. So some of the behavioural changes we're seeing with the satellites. Another thing that we're using the satellites for is to find other types of bird species as well. Now if you think about it, it's easy enough to see brown guano on white ice, but how do you see brown guano on brown rock? Not quite as easy from a remote sensing point of view, but actually it is possible, because And this question came to me by a Cambridge University scientist called Mike Brook, who works at the zoology department. He's like an extreme bird watcher. He goes out and tries to find birds in very, very remote areas. And he told us that the Antarctic petrel, which forages in the Southern Ocean, breeds on very remote Antarctic mountain ranges, often far inland. Extremely remote, where things will no go. We know that he thinks they're using shipborne surveys, which is a rather coarse way of doing it, but he thinks there are about 10 to 20 million of them in the Southern Ocean. But we only know where about 400,000 of them breed. So he was asking, he asked the question, can you find these by satellite? Well, I thought, it's brown, but it's not much, it's either white or it's brown guano. I won't be able to differentiate that. But definitely some Landsat imagery. So I had to play about with it. And as I said, Landsat, old images, quite coarse. But one of the good things is they don't just take visible light, they take light in the infrared bands as well. Seven bands altogether, in the mid-infrared and the near-infrared. And if you actually look at that infrared, so this is a daily penguin colony, small penguin. That's the Landsat image in the visible bands. And here's a map of the daily penguin colonies. You can see it's like, you'd never be able to say that was a penguin colony looking at the visible bands. So this red area is the protected area, it's a protected area, it's the map of it. But in the infrared, it sticks out like a sore thumb. So we've done some work, and we've got a paper in press at the moment showing that guano has got a totally unique signature in the infrared. It's got a different colour. If you could see infrared, guano would be a different colour to anything else. Because anything else in the natural environment. It's a very volatile mix of uric acids, ammonias and things like that, which don't exist in the natural environment because they degrade. And unless they're being continually replenished by the birds, they won't exist. So you can actually find this, and if you get a computer program which will actually look for this signature, you can actually pull it out quite successfully. And these are the pixels we can automate the computer to pull out. And we used a image processing software and an algorithm called a spectral angle mapper, which is quite a nice program, because rather than looking at the ratios, it looks at the pattern across the spectral bands. So rather than actually looking for actual values, it just looks for the pattern across the spectral bands. So it doesn't matter how much light there is, what the intensity is, it will still pick it out. It doesn't matter whether it's in shadow or if it's on the bright side. As long as the pattern is right, the colour is right, it will still pick it out. And that was very successful. We used the test area, the Landsat image again in Margaret
Bay. But presumably it still has to be incident white light, so to speak.
Yes, it still has to be sunlight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And not sunlight which has been reddened by low altitude.
No, but you can correct for that. Uh-huh. So you do an atmospheric correction.
Okay.
So we do an atmospheric correction on the Landsat imagery, on all of our imagery to pull that out. You can do a top of the atmosphere correction, and depending upon how high the sun is, how high the sensor is and things like that, which we know. So we usually do an atmospheric correction on that. So we used an area around our Rothera research station in Marguerite Bay where we knew we had a daily penguin colony. These yellow circles are places we knew were daily penguin colonies. We also knew there were other birds breeding there, and we wanted to see if it pulled out the other birds as well. And these are the results it gave us from the spectral angle mapper. The red dots are areas where we get multiple pixels. The green dots are areas where we get single pixels, which could have been noise or less likely to be, so they're close, but they weren't as large an area. And when we looked at these colonies, we could actually identify that all of them were in known bird locations. So if I show you, we picked out all of our penguin colonies that we knew about, plus, if you look at the red dots, several other colonies that we knew to be petrel colonies or fulmar colonies or shag colony, Antarctic cormorant colonies. So all of these areas, the red dots here, were known colonies, except for the Foray Islands. There were other areas that we didn't know about, which we didn't have a clue, were these real colonies that we just didn't know about, small colonies perhaps. Well, we thought we'd construct the Foray Islands and go and have a look, so we downloaded some high-resolution imagery. But the high-resolution imagery doesn't have the same spectral bands at the moment as the Landsat, so we can't look at the infrared. But it looked like there were pink stains on there. So we thought, well, what we'll do is we'll send a plane over to have a look. So earlier last year, I sent a plane over to have a look and see if it could see any colonies of birds there, do a visual search. And I was very disappointed when it came back and said it couldn't see any. There were no penguins there. And we couldn't, there were very few other birds there at all. Back to square one. But then, a chance phone call to an American biologist who went here. He said, oh, I know that area. It's a molting ground for penguins in the winter. So what we're finding here is it's not always a breeding ground that we're seeing. In this case, it's a molting ground that we're seeing in the winter. So again, you've got it's a bit outside the box. But we're still finding guano stains, but they're not always what we actually think they are. And in some cases, some of those stains may be soils which have been, because the guano stains are around in the soil for a long time, so they may be old deposits that have still got no breeding colony there anymore, but have had colonies in the past. What we're finding is orthogenically altered soils, pronunciation right. But it seems to be quite good at pulling those out. So we've got a paper coming out in the near future showing this, and people have been around looking for other colonies this way as well. So very interesting using the satellites. Another thing that we're looking at the moment, which we'll probably have, you have to think about this statistically, but I haven't done too much statistics on it at the moment, but it will add into the mix and has caused, if you'll excuse the pun, a huge splash. Are whales. We can actually see whales from space using these very high resolution images. The whales we're looking at here, we published a paper in February, the first successful example of counting whales from space. The Peninsula of Valdez, looking for southern right whales. Southern right whales are the ideal species because they spend a lot of time at the surface. In fact, the females in the breeding season spend virtually all their time on the surface because they have to support their calves, which can't swim. So they're underneath the calves, they have to support their calves because the calves are very poor swimmers. So they spend virtually all their time at the surface, they do no feeding in that breeding season. They image at the right time of year. They also like to congregate in large numbers in very sheltered locations. We find that in swell, in sea surface swell, we can't use this because the refracts the light of them, we can't use. But in sheltered locations where the right whales live or breed, then it's very, very effective. And we can do this quite nicely. And so we published something in February with some images on and showing an example. And not only were we able to see whales, and you can see these whales at the top, showing different types of behaviour, but we can actually automate the count as well. We used several different analyses to try and automate the count. We used a couple of different principal component analyses. K-means, I-means, and we used a supervised classification, which wasn't very successful, and a couple of different thresholding techniques, where you basically say you're looking for something that's lighter than the surrounding environment, across different bands, and it has to be above a certain size. And that actually worked very well. So these simple thresholding techniques worked very well. We did a manual count of the area. Now the manual count is, we had no other ground truthing to go on, so we had to make the assumption that the manual count was true, because we didn't have any ground truthing at this point. And we analysed how well the automated counts got to within the manual count, and I think the best estimate was about 87%. The red dots here, I'll talk about the red dots. One of the special things about the WorldView 2 satellite is not only has it got the highest resolution of any satellite at the moment, but it has what's called a coastal band, which looks at the far blue end of the spectrum. It looks at blue light, and blue light penetrates the water column, or at least it's not absorbed by the water column as much as other light, if you think that's why the sea's blue. because of that, it sees deeper into the water column. So looking for the blue, looking at just the blue band, then you can get really good results. So the red dots are things that were identified automatically only in the blue column. But we counted about 88 whales, it says 100 here, but it's actually 88 in our final analysis, I believe. And we classified them into things that looked like, so we classified them in a number of different ways. Basically, we asked, how do you know it's a whale? How do you know it's a whale? Because some of the images weren't as good as this. Well, and I thought about this for quite some time. And well, there are three terms. Is it the right size and shape for a whale? Yes. Is it in the right area where we'd expect to find whales? In this case, yes. And are there any errors of commission that we could have? Are there any other features that we might confuse it as, for instance, boats or rocks or things like that? Well, we knew what the bathymetry was here. It's a sandy bottom. There are no rocks, or at least the rocks were awash, and you could tell them. We didn't have any of it. But we can tell what boats look like. I don't have an image of a boat here, but you can tell what the boats look like as well with this 50-centimetre resolution imagery, so we could say that. So there are no real errors of commission here that we could tell. So on here, we're talking really, yes, if it's the right size and shape. Now, there were things that we saw in the water column that weren't the right size and shape, and we didn't know whether they were whales because they could be just deep whales. So we wouldn't see the whole whale if it was deep. So what we classed it as things that were the right size and shape, things that were in the water column that we classed as probable whales, things that were anomalies but weren't the right size and shape, so possible whales. And then there were other things that we could see as well, like birds or waves and things, occasional waves, that we classed as unlikely to be whales.
When you see a red superimposed on green there, the red is coming from the deeper water.
Yes.
And the green is?
That's from the, in this case, the green or the yellow is the panchromatic band. So it's just the black and white band, which gives you a higher resolution.
So you're actually seeing the same thing, but so in a different spectrum.
Yes, absolutely, we're seeing the same thing.
And then you also have some yellow bands on their own.
So in that case, the higher resolution is giving us an identification of something that's there, which we can't see in the lower resolution blue band. So the blue band gets The blue band has a resolution of about 2 meters, whereas the yellow dots have a resolution of about 50 centimeters. So that will give us a better indication. If we pull out other things. Some match, some don't match. So, this is really caused a lot of interest in the whale community. Counting whales is a very hot political topic. As you probably understand, Japanese whalers want to count them, people want to eat them, catch them. Some people have got Greenpeace, want to know how many there are, World Wildlife Fund wants to know how many there are. The right whale, for instance, has been seeing huge mortality events recently because they've been pecked to death by kelp gulls, so they want to count this particular thing. So our next step is to get a proper ground truth survey with aerial images to see what our counts are like in comparison to those aerial surveys. We can probably do them on the same day to give us an idea of actually what an aircraft can see. And again, the aircraft isn't particularly great because you're not, if you've ever been on a boat looking for whales, it's not easy, and it's not easy from an aircraft either, because you've got to be looking in the right place to see the whale blow, and you can only see so far out, and there's lots and lots of statistics to do with counting whales, either from aircraft or from planes. But they've been doing it for years, and this is quite new, so we're not quite down that far yet.
Could you do it with sonar from a boat?
You can do it with acoustics, but the acoustics won't tell you how many whales there are. You can try and triangulate acoustics, but it's not very good. So they do have acoustic buoys. You can tell species by acoustics, which is good. We knew that our species was southern rights because they're the only thing that's here. There aren't any other whales at this time of year. But you can tell species by acoustics. There are
one problem with acoustics, at least certainly where whales are concerned, is they might not like it.
Mm. Yeah, and actually, the person who usually does accounts of Peninsula is Vicky Roundtree. So we tried acoustic buoys, but what happens is the whales like to play with them, and they only last a couple of days before they're trashed by the whales.
Oh, I see.
So yeah, you get a couple of days good data from them, but that's about it. It's quite an expensive business to be. But then again, shipborne surveys, aerial surveys are all expensive businesses. Whereas we can do the whole peninsula of Eldez reasonably cheaply every day for a month if you wanted us to, and count it and look at changes and that, and get really good data sets and count. And for this particular thing it would work, it's going to work really well. For other species, we're looking now at other species like blue whales and humpback whales, and you know, the world's ocean is my oyster in this case, but there are more problems with that because they don't spend as much time at the surface, they're not in such calm conditions, and other reasons as well. So there's more problems with those, but for southern right whales, I think we've really got something to go with. And then there's seals as well. We can count eye seals. This is a Weddell seal. There are four types of eye seals in Antarctica. Weddells, crab-eater seals, leopard seals, and Ross seals. The crab-eater seals are thought to be the largest population of any other large mammal on Earth apart from man. And there have been estimates of somewhere between 7 million to 75 million of them. Just don't know, because they breed on the sea ice. And whereas the emperor penguins are always in approximately the same kind of places, the ice seals could be anywhere. So, and they take a large percentage of the krill from the Southern Ocean. So a big question there about this, and I think we can do experiments on this to automate sort of feature extraction of this and change detection to look at automating counts of ice seals. Again, that will probably give us lots of statistical questions about how we interpret that sort of data. Or, alternatively, you can look at thermal data. That's an aerial photograph of a penguin colony with some seals. And here you can see the thermal data. You've got penguins here, seals over here. These are elephant seals, so they jump on one. They're big heaps of elephant seals. They're not very easy to count. So that's another thing that we're thinking of doing. But for our satellite data, I think the future is this little beastie. This is the WorldView 3, which I'm hoping we'll go successfully this year. All my fingers and toes are crossed because it was due to go up in September, it's now due to go up in November. And this is going to give us 30 to 40 centimetres, depending upon what the US Senate allows us to have. Apparently, I think it takes it at 31 centimetres. They haven't decided yet what they're going to give us. Well, they tell us it's 31 centimetres, it could be a lot higher than that. But interestingly, it also takes the shortwave and near-infrared bands, and it takes, I think this takes 8 spectral bands, no, 16 spectral bands. So it gives us a lot greater spectral resolution as well. So we're getting higher spatial resolution, higher spectral resolution, higher temporal resolution, because they're going over, you get them twice a day if you want them, adding more. So it's only going to get more and more prevalent using satellites to do this sort of thing. And we can use this to do the guano estimates at 1 meter resolution, rather than the Landsat, which gives 25 to 30 meter resolution. So there's going to be lots and lots of things, and also be very good for whales as well. In fact, with whales, we might be able to look at the whale oil that they leave on the surface using the spectral bands. So, that's me. So I said lots of pictures, some stats and some interesting questions that we've got at the moment, but also that we're going to have to answer in the future, I think, as we start going down this this path of looking at more and more populations from space. So, enjoy.
Very interesting. Thank you very much. Any questions?
With the disintegration of the older penguins, in those freezing temperatures,
hatred of them, what happens?
When you say the disintegrations,
well,
you mean?
If they die and it's freezing, they're being in freezer.
Oh, so
are they lying around?
In some cases, the petrel, giant petrels do eat them.
So there's the connection where there's one brood.
Yes, but not always. In some cases, they die early in the year, the petrels won't be there, they only get there at certain times of the year. And in that case, just you get snow accumulation over the top of them, and they just go into the snowpack, that gets compressed down, it becomes ice, and it probably carve, thousands of years down the line, it'll carve off from the roof of the sea. So,
but then invisible.
Invisible, yes. And there are questions about snow accumulation when you're looking for the guano. Not so bad when you're looking for penguins, because the penguins are always there, but the guano sometimes gets covered by the snow. So actually finding them are good questions.
How confident are you that you've removed all those seals from your penguin camps?
For the emperor penguins, totally. They don't exist at the same time of year, and if they do, they look very different. And a seal is 8 feet, 6 feet long, and the penguins. So you can definitely talk. For the and I think that's pretty much the same for most of them. So yeah, we're pretty confident on that front. Even the land-based penguins, they tend to be the colonies of penguins are so big that if you get a few seals there, it's not going to make a lot of difference. Some colonies, I've got one colony on the Zabrowski Island, which is 1 to 2 million penguins, and it's, for instance, on our emperor penguin colonies, which are usually quite small in comparison to some, the average is about 5,000. For some penguin colonies, for some penguins, gentoos, they do breed in small areas, but they're up on the higher ground, so they don't tend to always inhabit the same areas. Seals tend to be on the beaches. So if you can misinterpret them when they're travelling to and for the things, but they don't tend to be in the same places.
It was interesting, you don't know how the penguins get off the ice shelf. Because, I don't know if it's something I've seen in a documentary, but I think they can sort of roll down a bit, can't they? Quite robust, their bodies.
Some of the smaller penguin species do climb, but the thought about emperor penguins were that they were always too clumsy, too large and clumsy to do any climbing, which is why they only... So you probably... There was a documentary last year, I think it was, called Life in the Huddle, or something like that, which had robotic penguins, and they took photos of things. And some of those penguins, some of the bushtail penguins, the macaronis and the South American penguin species, do climb quite considerable distances, but not the emperors. However, having said that, I was on the phone to the BBC the day before yesterday. They're having their latest blockbuster documentary series, and they want to go to that very penguin colony to see if they can photograph emperor penguins going up and down ice cliffs. So yeah, you might see it on the telly.
Presumably penguins have to enter the water to eat.
Yes, they have to find water to eat. Now, sometimes that can be ice cracks in the ice. As long as they can get down, like a seal, they can go under. They dive considerably, so they don't need large areas of expansive water. They can just find a crack and go in.
So therefore they inevitably find themselves in water, so they have to get back.
Yes. Mm. So they'll have to come back probably to the same place.
So there may be easier landing places, as it were.
There might be, yeah.
More of a shelf into the sea than a cliff.
Yeah, they've got a strange ability. It's only been found recently. They're actually jet propelled. What they do is they've got emperor penguins, a unique species. They, when they dive into the water, they fluff their feathers out and trap air. And if you've seen the documentaries, when they shoot out of the water, you always see a stream of bubbles. And that's not a chance thing. What they actually do is they squeeze their feathers, and that gives them
an
impulse, and also you get pressure differences, and it shoots them out of the water. They're very, very clever animals. Well, not clever, but very well adapted animals. So you get on the sea ice, you only get a free board and maybe a few feet because it's only other couple of metres deep.
And also with the bubbles in the feathers, you get extra buoyancy. So
yes.
That's another apparatus.
So they will, they can shoot out and jump several metres high from the water.
Is there any LIDAR data? Would that be a way to see penguins, or is that entirely based on aircraft, not satellites?
No, we've tried LIDAR. Well, the Germans tried LIDAR data. We thought it might be quite useful to try LIDAR data, but actually their results weren't as good as they hoped they would have been. And we tried other things as well. I thought thermal would be perfect, because thermal in the winter of an penguin colony would think would be great. And I asked NASA for their Landsat imagery, because the Landsat takes thermal data, but it didn't work. I've tried it in the summer, but they're well insulated, and what you tend to find in the summer is if there's instant light, the image is washed out by the aspect. So you get any iceberg that's facing the sun will be very, very hot, or have a lot of light, like, and the penguins don't show them. But I thought in the winter at least it would work, but it doesn't seem to. Having said that, I was told a few weeks ago that actually there was a problem with the Landsat data, so I might go back and try that again now they've corrected it this year or something, and it's coming up to winter. So I think it's worth pursuing that one thing with the thermal.
How close the colonies were, that they were within reach of each other, but presumably most of the walking they're doing is in the direction of the sea.
Absolutely, yeah.
So not naturally along the coast.
No, they don't, but they do forage when they go into the sea. They're going.
Well, they go out to the sea and there they forage.
They go out, yeah.
That's why they might
be missed. So the foraging distance when they're actually in the water is quite considerable. So they go very, very slowly when they're on land, but when they're in the sea, they're very, very powerful swimmers. And when the juveniles, they go all over the place. I found one on one of the you see them sometimes on the subantarctic islands. I saw one on the South Shetland Islands, which is way beyond their normal range. And it was a juvenile, and I asked one of the, this was before I started working on penguins, and I asked one of the bird ecologists about this, and she said, well, it's like teenagers going into leaving. What they do is they go and explore the world, and then they settle down in one place and never leave. So that's the analogy that she told me. The juveniles do go around and prospect for different areas. The thought is that when they actually settle down, they settle down in one place. But that's what we think at the moment. Whether it's true or not, if you get a catastrophic event or a change in environmental conditions, whether they do leave, we've still got to really fathom that now. Now, I'm going to be using a lot of stats in the future with all of these things, so if there's anybody who is particularly interested in helping with some of the more complicated aspects of it, or can give me any, because I'm not a statistician, I've just got some interesting statistical problems to deal with. I'm very willing to take any suggestions that you have. If getting my axes the right way around is a good start.
Okay, well, once again, thank you very much.